This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
A great way to understand the history of a region and its people is to study their music. And in Mississippi, that music is the blues.
The blues is the organic, earthly demonstration of what life is.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about the Mississippi Blues Trail and how it traces the history of this uniquely American genre of music from its roots around the state to cities around the world. Then we'll hear about another very little talked about community in U.S. history, the thousands of French Canadians who settled in northern New York and New England. And we'll spend an academic minute exploring what, if anything, the movie Black Panther tells us about African history. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. In Mississippi, they take the blues seriously. So about a decade ago, the Mississippi Blues Trail was established to educate people about the state's role in creating this very American form of music. Nominations for educational blues trail markers are taken for locations throughout Mississippi and other states, commemorating people, locations, and events that helped create the blues. Those subjects are then vetted and researched by blues historians, and only after that process is complete can a commemorative blues trail marker be set up. Kamel King is the Bureau Manager for Visit Mississippi and Director of the Mississippi Blues Trail. I asked him how this trail got started.
Sure. The Blues Trail got started actually about 12 years ago. In 2003, the Mississippi Blues Commission was created and brought together by Governor Haley Bryant, and they were tasked with bringing together and installing the Mississippi Blues Trail markers and coming up with a body that would actually vet and research blues artists and aficionados and venues and radio stations and sites and birthplaces and grave sites, all to commemorate the men and women and people and places that were paramount to the Mississippi blues sound catapulting throughout the United States and spreading throughout the South and the Chitlin Circuit, and then moving on to national recognition and, of course, what is matriculating into international recognition. And so these markers are historical markers that are based in Mississippi and throughout many other states and several other countries that are just important people, things, venues, railroad stations, radio stations, record labels that were center stones in making Mississippi and the Mississippi sound, and not only just the Mississippi sound, just the genre of blues period really just catapulted into the stratosphere.
And Mississippi does take ownership of the blues, doesn't it?
Most certainly. We are coined the birthplace of America's music, and we definitely boast to be the birthplace of the blues. We have many other sister cities and states that we work with and that, we are very well aware that are, very strong in the blues genre. But we definitely own the center of the blues, the heartbeat of it, the traditional blues that sprouted from gospel, that spread from the plantations and the sharecropper houses and the juke joints all the way throughout the rest of the world. The genesis came from Mississippi.
Now, if I take a look at the map of the blues markers, they are concentrated in Mississippi, but you've got a few in the other places. How has that been expanding throughout the country and the world, really?
Oh, it is going excellent. We're very proud that the Mississippi Blues Trail is the most noted and one of the most popular blues trails in the world. And so we have blues trail markers in other countries. By and large, most of them are based in Mississippi, but from Louisiana to California, to Arkansas, you know, all the way to the eastern seaboard. We have Blues Trail markers because these places were part of the web and the infrastructure that really helped move the genre along, and where other states and other cities and other cultures coalesced with the Mississippi culture and took the music to another level. And had it not been for the relationships with other states and the railroad stations in other states and the communities in other states that welcomed the Mississippi artists and helped them grow outside of their traditional areas, then the growth of Mississippi blues and the blues genre, period, would have been stunted.
You know, the one question I want to ask, and there's really no answer to this, but what are the blues?
The blues is life. You know, it is the ups and downs of life. And, you know, because it's called the blues and because, you know, people, you know, think of it as kind of the music of the downtrodden, or rather the nucleus of where it came from was the music of the downtrodden. And speaking of the hard times, that was only a part of it. Blues is really the, I want to say, the genre of life. It talks about the ups, the downs, the situations that men and women would be embarrassed of, the situations that we go through that in the shadows that no one really wants to talk about, the triumphs of our world in small factions and big factions. The blues is the organic, earthly demonstration of what life is. It is, whether it's slow or it's fast, and whether it's contemporary or it's traditional, it is really just the original storytelling of how life really is for the person behind the mic.
Kamel King is Bureau Manager for Visit Mississippi and Director of the Mississippi Blues Trail. You can find a link to a map of the trail at the Best of Our Knowledge page on WAMC.org. A professor at Siena College near Albany, New York, has embarked on a research project to investigate and preserve the heritage of French-Canadian workers in northern New York. French professor Janet Scheidler is trying to catalog and tell the stories of nearly 1 million miners, textile, and other workers who moved from Quebec to New York. She says the I Remember project stems from her graduate experience at McGill University in Montreal. She spoke about the project with the Best of Our Knowledge's Pat Bradley.
I began actually researching Franco-Americans, or descendants of French Canadians, in New England. And the reason why I focused on that region is because it was pure happenstance. I was putting myself through grad school at McGill and was a tour guide, taking people from Western Massachusetts up to Canada, and was hired to do that because, since my specialty at that point was French Canada. Well, surprise to me, as I looked at the list of passengers for one of those trips, I saw Courchene, Beauchemin, Leblanc, and every single name without exception was a French Canadian or a French name. And I turned to a gentleman in the front, Monsieur Rivard, and I said, "What is this about?" And he said, "We're Franco-Americans. All of our families immigrated from Quebec." And I said, "Wow, that's amazing." Now, this is, I won't date myself, but this is going back a few decades when there was really little known about this population of almost 1 million who had left French Canada to immigrate to the northeastern United States. I was stunned. And Monsieur Rivard, before he would let me change the subject, said, "You know, someone has to tell our story." So as I explain to people when I talk about this project, it's very much a project of the heart.
From what I understand, you are finding that many of these French Canadian immigrants tended to work in textile mills and mines. Is that the case?
Indeed. Now, you know, a great deal of research has been done regarding Franco-Americans in New England, but our focus is on New York, and so that adds some other dimensions. Mining, as you suggested, lumber camps, as well, and farming. There are people who, in essence, carried on the same type of livelihood that they left behind in French Canada, but did so by just crossing the border and establishing farmlands here.
You mentioned that more than a million French Canadians immigrated south to this region.
Yes.
Why did they come?
You know, it was sort of a combination, and I think in that way it's true for immigrants today, a combination of economic and political factors in the homeland and opportunity just south of the border here in the United States. So in Quebec, you had land that had been depleted because of being tilled, the soil tilled generation after generation. You had a government that at the time, and we're talking the 1830s, 1840s, insisted that that was the vocation of these people, that they were born and created by God to be farmers, and they should be happy. They should be content with that. So you had poverty, and you had people being told, but this is good. This is a blessing. And meanwhile, you see, they see some of their compatriots leaving and finding salaried work in the United States. We have, of course, the rise of the textile mills throughout New York, and I shouldn't say throughout New York, in Cahos, New York, and then throughout New England. And so word was out. Also, many of the companies sent some of those early French Canadians back to their villages to spread the word. So there was an active recruitment. Word might not have made it to 1 million people had it not been for the aggressive recruitment of, frankly, a cheap labor force.
Still to come, Pat Bradley's conversation with Dr. Janet Scheidler continues with a look at some of the stories of those Canadian immigrants. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Janet Scheidler, a French professor at Siena College, who is researching the history of early French Canadian immigrants to New England and northern New York in a project called I Remember. She's speaking about the project with The Best of Our Knowledge's Pat Bradley, who asked about some of the individual settlers' stories.
Yeah, there are multiple stories. The multiplicity and the richness of it is, I think, what people don't at first glance appreciate. And that was certainly the case for me when I started studying New England Francos. We think of textile mill workers, but of course there were also people who came because they knew that there would be this working class that would need a dentist and a doctor who would appreciate having a journalist who could write in their language. Priests, nuns. So you had virtually every socioeconomic class. You had whole families. You had single people who were just trying to make it to see if this would work, send money back home. They're successful, so the whole family comes. So you had a cross-section of French Canadian society, ultimately.
Are there any particular stories that have stood out for you and the students that you're working with to do this database?
You know, I think every story is unique and wonderful. It's difficult to pick on a single one. I will tell you one that I saw one of my students fighting back tears, and that's when I said, you know what? They get it. They get the importance of this. There was a woman who came to me, Claire Hamilton, who came to me early on before June 24th. I met her at a genealogical society meeting, and she said, my father was a Franco-American, and he was left by his father in an orphanage after his mother passed away. And I said, wow, that's incredible. That's a beautiful story. And she said, I have his medals from his service in the U.S. Marines. So I told her about June 24th, and I really sort of set it aside and reached out to her to make sure she was coming. She came with his medals, and she also came with a picture of her father. And as she was telling us the story, with which I was familiar, there were a number of Franco-Americans who were placed in orphanages when their families simply couldn't afford to take care of them. But what was unique about her story was that she went on to say that the father remarried and never came for him. So he reaches adulthood. He goes, strikes out on his own. And his sister, half-sister, is now left alone because his father passes away. And he took her in and took care of her. And between that and the stories she told of his service in Haiti on behalf of the U.S. Marines, I said, so what is it, Claire, that you want us to know about your father? And she said that he was an honorable man. And I thought, this is what this project is about. The ethnicity is of course, a central piece, but it's about lives that mattered and that still matter to those they've left behind, and making sure that those stories are told. Now, to go back to the immigrant piece of it, of course, it's about someone who was French-Canadian in origin, but also became very firmly American and served this country. So that's, when I speak of the richness of these stories, that to me is what has really blessed and privileged all of us to listen to.
That touches very much on a video. There's a short film showing what you and the students are doing mm-hmm. to document the French-Canadian immigrants. And, you know, a couple of the students talked about the importance of showing the diversity and the history of these groups. Do you think that that is particularly important now with the way the nation is?
Absolutely. We tend to look at Franco-Americans in particular as being a historic entity. And in truth, their story is the immigrant story. It's about people who leave behind everything that's familiar, take some of their customs and traditions with them in an effort to transplant those values and customs, and adapt to a new environment and contribute immensely to all of our society. And that, I think, is what is forgotten along the way.
Now, you are doing this with funding from the
National Endowment for the Humanities.
National Endowment for the Humanities through a Common Heritage Grant.
Exactly.
How long will you be able to continue doing this research with that grant?
That grant will expire in June of 2019. So come graduation, I'm going to be hitting the road again, because our next step, phase two of this two-part journey, is to come up to the North Country, to come where people are and listen to their stories and digitize their artifacts. So we're going to have to do so quickly. So we're going to be back here in Plattsburgh, probably a stop in Glens Falls along the way, Potsdam, Messina, Malone, Ogdensburg, and whatever, at Tupper Lake, whatever points in between as well. And then we have sort of an image, I have a vision of what I would love for us to be able to do after the fact, after we've completed the digitization piece of all of this.
I think a lot of people think of French-Canadian heritage mm-hmm. folks being in New York's North Country. I don't think they think of them
Absolutely.
Being further south.
Absolutely. Yeah. I spent years in Potsdam, at SUNY Potsdam, and I was amazed at exactly that. I worked with a student then, Guy Larocque, who, Franco himself, the two of us set out and were amazed at the French and the French-Canadian influence throughout. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, part of that is the geography, because they're a disparate group. We don't necessarily see what they share in common and how sizable the community was. 60% of the population in Tupper Lake at one time was French Canadian. And the same is true in other little pockets. We tend to talk, when we speak of New England, of the Petit Canada, the little Canadas that were that sector of the neighborhood that was largely French Canadian. But there are, as you undoubtedly know, there are French villages in virtually every upstate New York town as well. So it's going to be an exciting and quick trip come this spring.
Now, the website where the Je me souviens is currently located, mm-hmm. is that going to be expanded and publicly available?
It is publicly available, so anyone can view it anytime. It's at the New York Heritage Digital Collections. So what we do is we have a tiny URL so people can go directly. But it's a really exciting site, so I encourage people to go to nyheritage.org and then go looking for us, and you'll find us under Siena College, where we have, I think, four collections. But the Je me souviens is specifically within Siena College at that public website.
And if somebody thinks they have a story, mm-hmm. and they'd like to get a hold of you, how do they do that?
So there's a couple of ways. Certainly directly by my email at Siena, jscheidler@siena.edu. We've also established, because most people can't spell Scheidler or forget how to do so. So we've also established an email address that is neh-franco@siena.edu. And so we thought that might be a little easier for people to recall. So it's neh-franco@siena.edu.
Reporting for The Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Pat Bradley.
You can find history lessons just about anywhere, even where you least expect them. How about the Marvel movie Black Panther? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Marvel's Black Panther has been a worldwide sensation. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Ellen Stockstill, assistant professor of English at Penn State Harrisburg, discusses the film in the context of African history.
Marvel's Black Panther has earned over $1 billion worldwide since its release, and critical praise for its thought-provoking take on the comic book superhero. The film not only speaks to present-day conversations about race, politics, and moral action, but it also speaks back to the imperial ideology of the 19th century. In doing so, Black Panther reclaims an identity of innovation and advancement stripped from many African cultures during the age of imperialism. One popular idea during the 19th century was that ruins of cities found on the African continent could not have been designed and built by Black Africans. European explorers assumed, because of their racial bias, that Africans were too inferior to construct advanced cities. Probably the best example is the discovery of the ruins of Great Zimbabwe. When Europeans encountered the ruins of this medieval city in which 18,000 people once lived and was part of a large trade network, they concluded that such an advanced city could not have been built by indigenous people. This prejudice in mind, archaeologists who explored the ruins developed theories about an older, civilized, and white people who had long ago built the city and resided in it. Even after finding artifacts made by the native population, explorers refused to believe that the original visionary builders of the city were Black. Black Panther wonderfully rewrites this history with Wakanda, the most advanced nation on the planet, long hidden from the world's view. This nation, designed and built by Africans, reverses the discourse of European imperialism, showcases technological advancement on the African continent, and makes viewers wonder how different the world could have been. It also underscores how blind those European explorers were, refusing to see what was right in front of them: innovation, creativity, and civilization.
That was Ellen Stockstill of Penn State University Harrisburg. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.